In today's episode,
Arthur Frommer, who I don't know if you know who he is. He's the sort of the godfather of the travel industry. He's in his 80s now. He started all the Frommer's Guides to travel.
That, of course, yeah.
3 or 4 weeks ago in September, he predicted in the Wall Street Journal that cannabis tourism is going to be the next boom in the business of tourism in the United States.
This is Bilal Zaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by The Squarefoot. It's the simplest way to find office space. They have a beautiful website where you can transparently browse places by size, by neighborhood, and by price. They'll then pair you up with a salaried broker, so someone who's not incentivized just to rush you into a lease for their own benefit. They are incredibly transparent, and there are hundreds of companies like Breva, Instacart, and Casper who have already used their services. Please check them out on thesquarefoot.com/creatorlab today.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Bilal.
Could you just introduce yourself? We're going to go into your whole story in a minute, and you're already making faces at me. you've done so many things, but if I was to ask you who you are, we're already getting philosophical. Who are you, man?
Which one of me do you want to know?
Well, for today's purpose, you're the writer, journalist, speaker.
Author of Brave New Weed.
Okay.
Yes, I just spent 4 years reporting and researching and writing this book on what I call the uncharted world of cannabis, which is all the things you never really knew about the most ubiquitous plant in our lives, basically.
Okay. All right. So you're an author, and you help people with speaking engagements. And
I am a presentation trainer. Yes. I help people do the thing they hate the most, which is speak in public and talk to the media.
All right. Great.
Yes, I'm a trainer. I coach people.
And for 20 years plus, you were a journalist at several magazines.
Mostly like a magazine editor. Yes.
What sort of publications? Like Vogue, I remember was one.
I was the editor in chief of Details, which was a men's magazine when there were magazines. I was an editor at Playboy. I was an editor at Star Magazine. I was the editor in chief of Star Magazine. Mm. I turned it from a shitty newspaper to a shitty glossy magazine.
Great. So we're going to go into your book and all the stuff you've been talking about in the last few months. But for the moment, I wanted just to go back to your journalist days because, you know, you're still a journalist, you're a writer. And in the world of weed, you've been exploring as a journalist and writing about it. So it'll be fun just to hear some cool stories and some of your war stories from your 20 plus years. So I know you've interviewed a bunch of really cool people. So just a few that stood out: Nicolas Cage, Jamie Oliver, the chef, Hugh Hefner. Are there any others that really stand out to you?
Well, Hugh Hefner was a memorable interview, I will say, because I interviewed him in the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, no way.
And he arrived in purple pajamas and a robe. And that's how he did the interview. And he gave me many hours of his time. But I'll never forget that we were seated in a room. He was sitting on a couch. Mm. And every few minutes, he would just keep sliding down the couch like this until his back was almost on the cushion. And he had to pull himself back up again. And he also drank an enormous number of Coca-Colas.
Really?
An enormous number.
It's so weird. I've been coming across this Coca-Cola stuff. Like, I just read on the weekend about Bill Gates.
Another Coke fiend, right?
Yeah, Warren Buffett. And apparently Bill Gates, every lunchtime, he has a cheeseburger from McDonald's and a Coca-Cola.
Anna Wintour used to eat a cheeseburger at her desk when she was editing Vogue and I worked for her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the best time to talk to her, she was eating a cheeseburger with her sunglasses on.
All right, as you do. So yeah, let's go back to Hugh Hefner. So he was sliding down. You're in the Playboy Mansion. What else did you see?
It was incredibly revealing, though. I mean, he told me, I was the first person he ever admitted to that he had had sex with men.
Oh, really?
In different sort of group situations, mostly. Never one-on-one. Mm. But that was a quote that went around the world because he really never discussed that part of his personality before.
And what? So just to paint a picture, what year was this roughly when you did it? Do you remember, or what decade even?
I think it was the 90s.
So what was it like to be in the Playboy Mansion in the 90s?
It was a very large place, and there were grounds that had animals like a zoo around them. But there were no women around. It was me. No, it was like he had an enormous operation. He used to edit the magazine in his pajamas half the time from his bedroom. And I thought, God bless him. I wish I was successful enough to have
Isn't
a job
that what you
like
do
that.
Now?
Yeah, exactly. So you write a book typically. It was you know, a big, silly Hollywood house with lots of rooms and lots of wood paneling, as I remember.
Yeah.
I think he still lives there.
Oh, yeah.
I think he does. He was great. I loved him. You know, he was a journalist too before he became the icon of Playboy. That's how he started.
Yeah. What about like Nicolas Cage and Jamie Oliver? Do you remember any fun stories with them?
Nick, not so much, because we basically, you know, did a couple of interviews, but we didn't really tool around.
Okay.
Jamie was great because he gave me 4 or 5 days of his life.
Mm.
And it was when he was much younger. And, you know, I went to Essex where he was from. Mm. I went to his dad's tavern and pub, which is the place that he learned to cook. And we really talked about food and his dreams. And he was very real and authentic. And,
yeah.
You know, a lovely guy, really.
And this was like right in the beginning, so people didn't really know him.
Nobody in America knew him. No, I had found him on a trip to London, and I saw what an enormous impact this sort of raw talent was having. And I was impressed because I saw him on TV in Britain. Naked Chef.
Yeah.
And he just really loved to cook.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
Mm.
And I'm always attracted to that sort of raw energy.
Yeah.
It's a lot like people in the cannabis world today, actually. They just really love the plant. They love to make oils, or they love to grow it. They love to be around it. And I found the same sort of raw enthusiasm almost everywhere I went.
Same. Yeah. That's great. So we could probably speak for 2 hours about that world, but for the sake of time, we'll move on. So you've now just written a book, and you transitioned from writing for magazines for a long time to writing this new book. So how did that come about?
You know, it came about accidentally and serendipitously. A cousin of mine started growing, and he woke me up one day when I was staying there, and he said, "You want to see this new hobby of mine?" And he brought me down into the basement and showed me these Mylar bags, which he unzipped. And in it, he introduced me to his girls. There were about 2 dozen cannabis plants who were growing very happily there. And he then introduced me to something called Super Lemon Haze, which was a strain, a more sativa-like strain, a sort of a buzzier, uppier strain, which I had never had any experience of. And I tried some, and I thought it was sort of fantastic, really.
So
I thought, you know, maybe I should reacquaint myself with this plant, because I hadn't really partaken in about 15 years.
Yeah. And I noticed when you've talked about marijuana, weed, whatever you want to call it.
Cannabis. I prefer.
Okay. I see that you always mention that it's a plant first, right? And other people, when they describe it, you do. But a lot of people will, the first thing they'll call it is a drug. And there's a big difference between calling it a plant and a drug. So could you just go into that? Like, is that a conscious thing, or is it just something now you've got used to calling it?
It's a great question. Thank you. It is conscious.
Mm.
It's the same reason I call it cannabis. I've made some conscious decisions about the words we use here.
Yeah.
Because it is a plant. It's a plant that has psychoactive properties. It's a plant that has healing properties. And I think the drug wars in America and around the world have sort of cast it in the same category as other harder substances that are more addictive and can kill you.
Mm.
Cannabis can't kill you, never has, never killed anybody in the history of recorded time for a scientific reason, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
But it is a plant. It grows in the earth, and it has a different relationship with human beings than synthesized pharmaceuticals, i.e. cocaine or heroin, that have different effects and are much stronger. I think of cannabis more in the same way that people, the natives of South America, will chew a coca leaf all day long and get a very sort of subtle enhancement to their lives, or whatever, enable them to work harder or longer or eat less.
Yeah.
I think of cannabis more in that realm, not in something that's synthesized and gives you a fast up and a sort of a very low down.
Okay. Okay, we'll get back to drug versus plant in a bit.
Anytime.
But so So just on that topic, so why do you think it has been such a taboo topic for such a long time? And we're seeing in the last 5 to 10 years especially, there's been this change of mindset. There's been a bunch of states in the US that have started to legalize cannabis. Just because, you know, from my perspective, like my mom's listening to this, right?
Hi, mom.
Hi, mom. And to put it bluntly, she doesn't know the difference between cannabis or even cocaine or any hard drug. So to her, it's all drugs and it's all bad. So to someone like her, what would you explain cannabis to be? I know you kind of touched on it before, but to say it's not maybe as bad as you think it has been for the last 30 years.
Well, it's been... The history of cannabis is a stunning and often surreal history to research and to write about. I spent a year just trying to really get my mind around it because I never thought governments could be that effective at really demonizing something like the way cannabis has been demonized. Yeah. But the history of it, which I wrote about in quite some depth, I think, is pretty remarkable. And it really, the demonization began in the 1920s in the U.S., primarily when a bunch of Mexican immigrants started flooding over the border in exile from the Mexican Revolution. And with what they carried with them was this plant. And a lot of American lawmakers who didn't want all these brown people coming into their lives figured out it was easier to ban the plant and sort of demonize it than to ban the people, which is hard to do in America.
Yeah.
And they started mythologizing it, passing laws against it, and eventually banning it from the American pharmacopoeia, which is what all doctors use to prescribe from. And in 1942, they actually stopped doctors from prescribing it, and the demonization really got into high gear. And it was particularly in high gear in the 1960s under Richard Nixon, who hated hippies because they hated the Vietnam War and were making his life very unhappy. So he chose to demonize cannabis as well. And then Ronald Reagan turned the war nuclear in the 1980s. And that's
People call the war on drugs?
It is the war on drugs, yes. And cannabis was a main victim of the war on drugs. And at some point I'll explain to you why Ronald Reagan is primarily responsible for the power of today's weed, which is about 6 times as powerful as the weed that was available in the 1960s.
Since we're talking about it, why is that?
Well, Reagan turned the war on drugs nuclear, and he started spraying paraquat over the grows in the western United States and in Hawaii. Mm. And the growers basically had 2 options at that point. They were either going to go to Amsterdam to continue to grow, which many of them did, or they were going to move their crops indoors or hide them under trees so they were much less visible from the air. And when you go indoors, you suddenly have a problem. You have a problem about space. So they selectively bred smaller, more powerful plants. Mm. And they threw out the weaker varieties and self-selected the stronger varieties. And that's why in the 1980s, cannabis got very strong. Mm. And people like, you know, I was a casual user in the 1980s. I didn't know what was going on, but I noticed, wow, it was getting expensive and it was getting powerful. Mm. And it was really because of Ronald Reagan. So we have him to either thank or not, depending on your perspective.
Someone needs to make a meme about that. It looks All right, cool. So, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of history behind it. People should go and check out your book, which goes into that in a lot of detail. But let's fast forward to today. And we're now at a stage where several states in the U.S., 4 states, what is it, Colorado, Washington?
Well, today it's Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska, and the District of Columbia.
Okay.
But probably by the time this airs, it might be maybe 9 states. And my prediction is that California will obviously vote to legalize, and that's going to be a game changer.
Yeah. And just to differentiate, there's a difference between for recreational use and medical use, right?
We call it adult use and medical use.
Adult use.
Well, recreational is a little...
Sounds like...
It's a little diminutive. You know, it just sounds like, oh, let's go out and party. And I like to think that I'm an adult and you're an adult, and we have a choice on what we use to change our consciousness. You could do yoga, you could do sport, you could drink wine, you could drink single malt scotch, you could use cannabis, you could use psychedelics.
Yeah.
You're an adult.
Or all of those things at the same time.
Never. Absolutely never.
I'm joking. All right. So, there's a differentiation to be made there. There's also a differentiation to be made between decriminalization versus legalization, right?
Yes, yes.
And I listened to an interview with Obama recently. He was on Vice talking about this. And he was saying there's a difference between decriminalizing something and not necessarily encouraging its use.
Well, decriminalizing is a very selective thing. For example, it's been decriminalized in Holland for 40 years.
Yeah.
But it's still illegal to grow it. So there's a huge mystery. How do all those coffee shops and dispensaries, they don't call them dispensaries, but how do all the coffee shops get their weed? Where is it coming from? Everybody knows it's grown in Holland, but it's still against the law. So it creates this funny gray area that's, I think, very wrong. I think you neither need to accept it. Well, I think you need to accept it, period.
Yeah.
And I think you need to regulate it, tax it, test it, make sure that we know where it's coming from and that the end user knows exactly what he or she is using. I think that's crucial. But I also think that that's radical.
Yeah.
When you educate the population, all bets are off at that point because you're never going back.
Mm.
Once people know what they get, they're not going to give it up again. It's like alcohol.
Yeah. I was just about to ask, actually. So, I mean, I don't know the history of alcohol either, but there was an era where you couldn't buy alcohol legally too, right? The prohibition.
In the United States, yes, we did that.
So are you, from your research and your investigation, are you seeing a lot of parallels between that time period and this time period?
It's not quite the same, but there's interesting similarities. For example, what happened with alcohol after the prohibition and then it was reconstituted again, you know, people started coming up with the idea of drink responsibly.
Mm.
They also started measuring. So they enacted standards. So like today, we don't even have to think about a shot of spirit being equal to a 5-ounce glass of wine, being equal to a 12-ounce bottle of beer. We know, basically. And we know how to regulate. And we know how to monitor. And most adults know how to do that. Well, that was a result of standards, which is what we currently don't have with cannabis. It's a little trickier with cannabis, not as easy because alcohol is more uniform in its effect. Cannabis is different if you eat it or vaporize it or smoke it. It's all very different what happens, and there's a chemical reason for that. So we need to work on the standards. But again, once people know that, they're going to be able to monitor, and there's going to be a lot less unhappiness and discomfort from eating way too many pop brownies, for example. You know, the days of Alice B. Toklas brownies are rapidly coming to an end, and they're already at an end in many of the legal states.
Yeah. All right. So why has it taken so long for this to happen? I mean, there's probably many factors there, but this has been going on for some time, and there's plenty of states already started. Is it because of lobbyists? Is it because of Big Pharma? Is it because of taboos in society? What do you think that the reason is?
You can turn a corner and find a reason. I mean, a lot of people think, the fact is in the beginning, in the 1930s, when the demonization began, alcohol companies were very against it being legal. They had a lot of lost time to make up for because of prohibition. So they fought very hard to demonize the plant. And then pharma companies had a similar issue, apparently. It's very hard to prove anything with pharma companies because everything is very on the QT. But they didn't really want something that you could grow in your backyard supplanting their particular brand of medicine.
Mm.
And then politics have made it really murky. Like you said, your mom doesn't know the difference between cannabis or heroin.
Yeah.
My mother certainly didn't. And she always thought that if I came home a little high that I was going to be shooting heroin the next day. And, you know, we have an entire generation, two or three generations that know and prove that there is no such thing as this gateway theory.
Yeah.
We do not have a country full of heroin addicts or cocaine users. We don't. It's just not that big. It's a problem.
Yeah.
But I think opiate use, which is available by prescription, is a much larger problem today.
Mm.
The legal drugs have turned out to be the killers
and
the things that people are getting addicted to.
So on the gateway drug thing, so is it fair to say that not everyone has to be doing heroin and cocaine to for it still to be a gateway drug? Or do you think, I mean, it doesn't mean like 10 out of 10 people have to then have gone on to harder drugs for it to be a gateway drug. I guess it depends on the definition.
Well, that's what a gateway drug is. Okay, once you try cannabis, it's going to lead you. Now, there is a truth to the fact that once you try using substances, you know that they're not all as evil as they're cracked up to be. So it does take away a barrier of fear. Okay. Yeah.
So people
that's what
up,
I think is the gateway, okay? But it's not that try marijuana, have to use cocaine, have to shoot heroin, have to drop acid. It isn't like that at all. Cannabis is not an addictive, physically addictive substance. As a matter of fact, people are now using it as exit drugs, as a drug to get off of more addictive substances, which is really interesting.
Yeah. So we're going to go into some of the positive aspects of some of the research that you've been looking at. But before we get into that, there are obviously some, you know, there are some problems as well. And there are definitely people that in the long run maybe don't benefit from using marijuana. Like there are plenty of people that don't benefit from having alcohol forever either and other things.
I think so.
So if we were to talk about some of those bad things as well, from your research, were there a few things that really stood out there?
It's really hard to know because, you know, politically, we have an entire government institution called the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, NIDA, that has been for the last 50 years trying to find all of the deleterious effects of cannabis. And they've come up with things like it grows breasts in men, or it lowers your sperm count, or it causes lung cancer, or it makes you schizophrenic. And none of those things have ever really been proven. I mean, from my own experience, I can tell you that anybody who smokes too much is going to end up being a little dull. There's going to be just a blockade between them connecting. I think cannabis used mindfully and moderately can really enable intimacy and connection. But I think when overused, it tends to create a barrier between people, I've noticed. That said, it's never been shown that there's any sort of lung damage from cannabis. In fact, it's actually now being shown that they use it to help people with asthma because it's anti-inflammatory and it helps shrink some of the enlarged tissue that people with asthma have. So it's very interesting. Look, I think you can overuse any substance and suffer for it. It can be sugar. It can be caffeine. It can be fat. It can be trans fat. We know that as human beings, X number of people are always going to overuse something.
Yeah.
But to me, that doesn't ever justify banning it outright.
And the last part on that is, considering all of that, do you still see any dangers to making it legal?
Making it legal?
Yeah.
I think we have to make it legal intelligently. So I think, you know, obviously I don't want my pilot using cannabis when he's driving my airplane. I don't want my bus driver. I don't want the person driving my car either. I mean, I think we have to be very clear. It's not helpful in those situations. Yeah. It's not helpful if you have to do something that involves other people. You need, you know, you need a clear brain. You need a clear mind. You have to know when to use it and when not to.
Yeah. Same as alcohol, I guess, in that way.
I would say yes, exactly.
So what about if you, I don't know if you have kids, but if you had kids...
I don't have kids.
Well, let's pretend you do. Okay. would you be comfortable with them trying the plant? And
oh, yes. I have nieces and nephews. And as a matter of fact, one of my very clever little nephews, when I was he was about 15, he came into the house and he said, "Hey, Uncle Joe, there's two kids outside on the stoop smoking a joint. Why don't you go interview them?" And I looked at my sister and I said, "Can we talk about this?" And she said, "Absolutely." So, you know, I had to sit him down and explain what I was doing and why I was doing it and why I thought it was important to understand. But, you know, I'll tell you, I come from an Italian-American family. When I was 13, my parents sat me down at the bar, and they poured me wine, and then they poured me spirits, and then they taught me, okay, when you have spirits, make sure you put an ice cube in it, make sure you drink water in between the drinks, okay? And, of course, I immediately went out and disobeyed every rule they had and got sick to my stomach and for days puked. But as an adult, those lessons really served me, I have to say, because I never had to think about it again. I knew how to drink. I don't like being drunk, and I don't like the hangover, certainly. I mean, I've certainly done it, but it doesn't appeal to me. And especially as an adult, it appeals to me even less. So I think we have to educate kids what it is, how to use it, how to know when to stop, when not to use it. I think it's crucial. Otherwise, you know, that's when trouble happens.
Yeah.
When you don't educate people, that's when trouble happens.
Yeah. So do you think, just coming back to what Obama was saying, right? So he says, we need to decriminalize for other reasons, which we'll go into a little bit later. But we don't necessarily want to encourage its use, or he doesn't want to come across as encouraging its use, probably.
Of course he doesn't.
Yeah.
Of course he doesn't.
If that's the case, can we ever get to a stage where we're decriminalizing something? To me, in my head, if you're decriminalizing something, it doesn't necessarily mean you're encouraging, but you're moving it in that direction. So,
well, I think legalization is about giving people, look, already there are probably 80 million people who use it in America alone, okay? So it's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Let's use it intelligently, and let's tax and regulate and test and do all the smart things that will make the experience better for everybody and the society at large. But to put people in prison for this, or to ruin their lives or confiscate their property, which is still going on, and worse, to keep people who need it medically and who can benefit from it medically away from it, is insane. And I think that's criminal. I just did a talk last week, and the average age of the audience was in their 60s, and they were deeply curious about the medical benefits. But we live in New York. They can't get access. I brought a bunch of products to show them, and they were
show and tell.
It was show and tell, and they were fascinated and really upset at the same time because they couldn't get them. And that is insane.
Yeah.
And cruel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess 80 million people are getting some forms of it.
Yeah,
but not in that particular form.
You can't use it medically. You can't get a doctor to help you. What's the right dose? What's the right strain? Is it better to eat it, better to use it sublingually, better to smoke it? How do I use it for my condition? There's a real lack of information in the non-legal states in which we live, unfortunately, in New York.
Okay. No, that's really interesting. So if we talked a little bit about some of the bad things, but there has been a lot of research to show that there's been a lot of positive outcomes from using, you know, microdosing of cannabis and all sorts of different forms, and you talked about some of those there. What were some of the surprising things that you've come across that you were like, oh, I didn't realize when you were doing the research that it was actually positive?
So many things. Like, I didn't know there was a receptor system in the body called the endocannabinoid system, which is the largest receptor system in the human body that exists in the brain and in all the organs. So that's why cannabis has an effect on so many different illnesses. When you first read about it, you think, wait a second, what is this? This is like a joke, right? How could it affect lungs? How could it affect pain? How could it affect migraines? How could it affect bone healing? How could it affect Parkinson's or all of these diseases of spasticity? But when you understand how this system works, it's a revelation, really. And also when you understand that we know nothing about it as regular citizens, and most doctors don't know very much about it because it isn't taught in medical school, because frankly, there has been up until now no medicine to prescribe, so why bother teaching it, right?
Yeah.
It drives you crazy. Yeah. But it's fascinating to know that it can be used in so many different ways for so many different illnesses. And over the 4 years I spent reporting this book, I interviewed hundreds of people with so many different illnesses, like cancer, brain. It's very effective on a particular kind of brain cancer, for example, called glioblastoma, which is called the terminator because it happens so quickly. Like, you get it, I think the average window is 8 months, and then you're dead. So I met people who've had it who were alive for 3 years through using allopathic medicines, radiation and chemotherapy, plus cannabis. And that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's very promising.
And from the research I did, I saw there were uses for epileptic seizures, glaucoma, certain types of cancer. But I heard you mention there's 300 different types of cancer.
There are 300,
So obviously not all of them, but there are some. And I guess the whole point, though, is there's not that much research that's out there yet because it's still very early. And the way that research is done, it sounds like we've only been investigating what's wrong with it rather than the positive sides to it.
That's true and not true. In the United States, yes, we've only looked at primarily the negative effects. However, In Israel, which is the capital of cannabis research, which is where THC and CBD were discovered in 1964,
There have been many studies.
Actually, sorry, could you, for people that don't know what that means,
THC is the psychoactive component of cannabis, and CBD is the more anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial, sort of maybe the more health beneficial parts, although they're both, they work best when they're together.
Yeah. Okay.
So they that was discovered in 64, and the Israelis, funded by the U.S. because it's illegal to research cannabis here, have done many studies, as has most of the world. There's actually been over 10,000 studies on many of the effects of cannabis. Not many of them are clinical studies because those involve vast amounts of money and pharmaceutical companies. Mm. So these have been preliminary studies, but the evidence is pretty impressive. When I was in Israel, for example, I interviewed a pain specialist. Mm. Israel has the largest state-supported medical cannabis program in the world. It has over 20,000 patients in it. Nobody in America knows this. Most people in the world don't know this, but they've been running this program for maybe 8 or 10 years now. So I interviewed a pain specialist in a very large hospital who's been using it for 10 years, and she's treated over 1,500 people with it. And she said to me in no uncertain terms, look, this is the best medication for all different types of pain, neuropathic pain, chronic pain, even phantom limb pain, where if you've lost your arm, you still feel pain in your fingers, even though they don't exist. Go figure that out.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of evidence that it can be used. And by the way, the Israelis, it's part of their national health system, so their insurance covers it.
All right. No copay.
Actually, if you need over 30 grams a month, it costs you, but they provide 30 grams a month.
How does that compare to like California? Because California has, you can get medical cannabis there.
It's
right?
not state supported though. It's just like you go to a dispensary, you buy what you want, and you hope for the best. Or if you're lucky, you get a cannabis physician who's actually working with you to treat the illness. But in much of California, it's pretty much go to the dispensary, talk to the bud tender, see what they have to offer, and try it and see if you can get to a good place.
Okay. Now you said bud tender, it kind of leads us on to the next thing I was going to ask you about, which
What's
is
that?
The business of cannabis, which is obviously changing quite drastically, given the legality. So could you paint a picture for what the current landscape looks like in the U.S. specifically?
It looks schizophrenic. there's four legal states.
Yeah.
They all have different rules and regs. Colorado is the strictest and the most successful, I would say.
In what way? What do you mean by successful?
It's highly profitable.
Oh, okay.
The rules are very clear. You know what to do. You know what not to do. Here's the deal on the regs in Colorado. I looked at the gun regulations in Colorado versus the cannabis regs, okay? Gun regulations have 18,600 and something words. Cannabis regulations, 227,000 960 words.
Forgot.
Okay, it's a 210,000 word difference. That's how regulated cannabis is. Yeah. Okay, this is regulating something that has never killed anybody versus on the face of the earth versus a gun, which is pretty much intended to kill something. Okay,
yeah.
So that's how regulated it is. Washington, Oregon are a little more in flux. They still haven't quite figured out where they stand. Alaska, I'm not really aware. I haven't been there.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Canada is about to do federal legalization in 2017. Mm. So the picture looks like we're going to have about, if California votes yes.
When's that supposed to happen?
November 8th. November. It's a ballot initiative called Proposition 64. It looks like it's going to happen. That's about 85 million people in North America that have access to legal cannabis. That's not including the medical states. That's just full access across the board. That's a lot of people. Mm. That's going to change the game. That is going to really change the game. You cannot build a wall to stop the flood of information, the flood of educated consumers that have this. And again, I can tell you, when I come from the legal states back to a place like New York, everybody wants to know what I know.
Mm.
They all want access. Especially people, I'm in my 50s, so people want
to know about, how can I solve some of these pains that keep cropping up?
Yeah.
You know, that I wasn't really prepared for when I was in my 40s or in my 30s. Yeah. You know, bodies change.
Do you think people could actually use it less just because when something's illegal, there's kind of like a coolness factor
Definitely.
To it?
Absolutely. I think the conversation's been dominated by sort of the High Times crowd, which I, you know, good for them. They kept this conversation alive and they certainly kept the seeds going and growing. But, you know, in alcohol prohibition, when you found a bottle of scotch, you bought as many of them as you possibly could because you never knew when the next one was coming. It's never been quite that desperate with cannabis, but I think there is this culture of smoke as much as you can, get as high as you possibly can, and whoopee. I don't think that's key. I don't think that's the way it's used best, actually.
Yeah. So that's kind of painting a picture where we are today. What about, let's say, 5-10 years from now, where do you see some of that going? Not just in terms of legality in states, but in terms of the actual business side of things. Because we're going to go into different parts of the business in a second. But
the business is complicated. Right now, the money says, don't touch the plant. Do what Levi Strauss did. Get the picks or get the axes, okay? So you got a lot of people going into the compliance area, into regulatory, blah, blah. You got a lot of people trying to create seed-to-sale computer systems, a lot of IT going on now, trying to help this business actually mature and go from things that are written on the back of an envelope into, oh, here's a computer program that can actually help us track where things are going, and it's going to be necessary because it is going to be regulated and taxed. So there's a lot of that. So I think the growing will continue. I think if you're in a state like California, for example, I look at California because A, I've spent most time there, and B, it's the most mature market for cannabis. So what I think will happen is there will be sort of, I look at the beer model. I think the beer model is the most explicit and comparable. You've got about 80% of that market owned by the Coors and the Anheuser-Busches, and they're producing, you know, middle of the road standard beer.
Yeah.
Then you've got 20% producing specialty IPAs and Hefeweizens and, you know, every lager
fancy
and
stuff.
Ale. Yeah, all the fancier stuff with different flavors, different nuances, you know, really sort of making that market robust and interesting to me. And I think the same thing is going to happen in cannabis. You're going to have industrial grows, which are massive. And that's going to supply sort of average, not expensive, middle-of-the-road weed to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Marijuana, if you will. Okay? But then I know that there are growers who are going to grow heritage strains that are special and interesting and will take a certain level of consumer to a whole nother place. And that'll probably be 20% of the market. And I think that's how it's going to break down. I always think there's going to be interesting growers trying to do interesting things with the plant.
Yeah.
That's always how it has been.
That's interesting. So what about tourism? So I read that in Colorado especially, there's this whole new area of weed tourism. I think Vice even did like a documentary on it.
I can't wait to do those stories either. I'm so excited by them. Arthur Frommer, who I don't know if you know who he is. He's the sort of the godfather of the travel industry. He's in his 80s now. He started all the Frommer's Guides to travel.
That, of course, yeah.
3 or 4 weeks ago in September, he predicted in the Wall Street Journal that cannabis tourism is going to be the next boom in the business of tourism in the United States, which is really interesting.
So do you think people would be doing that if it's legal everywhere, though?
Yeah.
Because why do you need to go to Colorado if you can do it in New York?
Because Colorado's more beautiful.
All right.
Because skiing in Colorado is better. But you can go to Jamaica. You can go to Uruguay.
Yeah.
You can go to Chile, which is going to, I think, legalize pretty soon, too.
Okay, so there's people going specifically for that purpose. In the same way people go to wine country for
exactly.
wine and they're exploring that
world. Yes, and also to I think there is a level of tourist, educated cannabis tourist, that wants to explore different strains and wants to understand what a sun-grown strain in Humboldt County is and how it differs from perhaps something grown indoors by this special grower in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah. there's always going to be the hipster who's going to one-up you, right?
There is, but there's also always going to be, just like wine, different soil, different climate, different sun, which is going to create a different plant with different qualities. And cannabis is so complex. It's like about, I don't know, last count there was something like 760 different compounds in them, and they keep discovering new compounds all the time. So those climactic conditions really vary the strain and the quality and the texture of what you're getting.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I never thought of that before I started thinking about this book. I always thought, all right, strains.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really count. It's sort of like a joke, but they really do matter.
Yeah. What about Big Pharma? So you mentioned the alcohol companies. So you said previously they were fighting this. They didn't want it to happen. But now they can see it's pretty much happening already. Do you think there's been a change of mindset there?
Yes and no. I think cannabis is, and I want to look at Big Pharma more. It's very hard to get them to tell you much. I have to tell you, I have to get on the inside of it. Cannabis is tricky. It has an effect called the entourage effect, which means you can't just pull one cannabinoid out of it and expect it to have this response. It's not like a single bullet pill. We're used to these very specific medicines produced by Big Pharma, right? Cannabis doesn't work like that. It works when it's together, and a whole plant extract is showing right now to be most effective. Now, here's the problem for Big Pharma. You can't patent a plant. You just can't patent it. So they got to figure out a way in to the plant. A lot of companies are going the nutraceutical model, which
is that mean?
It's more like a supplement.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to go through clinical trials. And they can do whole plant extracts, and they can maybe stress different cannabinoids for maybe for different effects. But it's still a very uncharted territory. We don't really know how this is all going to play out. But what they have shown is that these different cannabinoids, so let me explain what a cannabinoid is.
Yeah, I was just about to ask.
Yeah. So THC and CBD, the aforementioned, those are the two main components of cannabis. But there are about, I mean, when I last looked, there were about 68 active cannabinoids.
So cannabinoid is
a compound that has a bioactivity, okay? And they do interesting things. For example, there's one called CBN, which is basically found in old weed. So when you have old weed in the garage for 3 years and you pull it out, it looks dry. It is dry. But it isn't going to make you very high, but it is going to make you very tired. Mm. CBN is a byproduct of weed that's been around too long. It's great for insomnia. Mm. Okay. There's another one that everybody wants the keys to. It's called THCV. THCV is an appetite suppressant. Now think about it.
Wonder why people want to
think about this. Yeah, exactly. An appetite suppressant that grows in the ground and doesn't make you feel like dirt.
Yeah.
Right? Because every diet pill we've ever had either makes you feel really rough or clearly doesn't work.
Yeah. It sounds like the opposite of what I thought.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
I thought weed is supposed to give you the munchies.
Some strains do.
Yeah.
Other strains that are higher in this cannabinoid called THCV have the opposite effect. Mm. Very interesting, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a, with certain areas of cannabis, like everything has an action and an equal reaction, right? Like the right dose of cannabis will stop nausea, and too much can make you vomit.
Yeah.
Certain cannabinoids. Look, the problem with THCV is it's in tiny, tiny amounts. So they're having a very hard time growing plants with massive amounts of this. So there's a lot of ways to go still. We're just at the precipice now of understanding the plant.
So as this whole area is booming, and do you have any rough numbers in terms of growth, like year over year, in terms of revenue that's coming in those?
There is none.
Okay.
But I can tell you what we know. So in Colorado last year, cannabis revenue was $1 billion over estimates. Tax revenue was $136 million. Now, in California, I've read a wide variety of estimates. Let's say it's safe to say by the time California goes legal and actually gets their laws in place, which is going to take another 2 years. First year revenue is estimated at around $30 billion.
So 30 billion. Times the amount of Colorado.
Yes, well, it's also about 12 times as many people. There's 40 million citizens of California and only 5 of Colorado, okay?
Yeah.
But the tax revenue is supposed to be between $1 and $2 billion year one. And California already produces more specialty cannabis than anywhere else in North America. So it's already a robust market. It's gonna really, you know, blow things away. And with 40 million people having access to it, I mean, it's not exactly the right number because only a certain number of them are of legal age.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to change the game.
Yeah.
And I think all bets are going to be off in terms of the revenue that this can produce for it. I mean, California already is the world's sixth largest economy. Okay, it's massive. And it's a massive agricultural state. So it's sort of built for cannabis.
Yeah. Last question on the business side of things. Any area like this that's booming and growing, there's always going to be investors in there, right? So it looks like a lot of the big pharma companies are looking at ways that they can, maybe not pharma companies, but also the tobacco industry, I think, was looking at it as well.
Private equity. Venture capital.
So I saw Snoop Dogg has a fund.
He does. Well, Snoop has a company called Leafs by Snoop.
That's it. I don't know the full structure, but I think he has a fund as well as several ventures in that area.
Well, the Marley family has an enormous company called Marley Naturals, I believe. They're producing beautiful products.
US.
They're in the U.S., and I believe they're in Jamaica. I'm not sure where the center of their operation is. It is run by the American Marleys. It's run by some of the younger ones. Mm. There are many companies out there. Willie Nelson has a company.
All right.
I mean, Melissa Etheridge is doing it. Whoopi Goldberg has a company.
Really?
Yes. These are just sort of the celebrities we know.
Mm. So do you think, I mean, these are already massive names in popular culture. Is there still this element of, you know, it being taboo for a certain segment of society? And how long do you think that will take to go away? Or do you agree there is?
Hey, the Mormons still don't drink alcohol. I mean, you know, there are certain people who are, Kansas is still a dry state. Yeah. There are some people who are never going to abide by this.
Yeah.
And there's going to be other people who are going to make a hell of a lot of money on it. And then there's going to be a lot of people who aren't getting arrested anymore.
Well, actually, that transitioned us perfectly into the last part. That
it's
I
really important part, by the way.
Talk to you about the social impact of this, and specifically the prison system. So, there's a couple of facts here that I had researched. So, one is that the U.S. population is only 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And you're rolling your eyes for people that can't see. And specifically for people of color, white, Caucasian, I think this is men, but it could be both. White Caucasian men in the US will use drugs 5 times the amount of African Americans. But African Americans are 10 times more likely to be put in jail for those minor offenses.
Look, I'm white. And it's absolutely true. I have always known that I can do whatever drug I want. And if I get caught, I'm going to get a slap on the wrist. And I'm going to get a fine probably, or maybe spend a few days in jail.
Mm.
But man, if I was a person of color, it would be a ticket to Orange.
Yeah.
And that is the truth. Okay. And all of the numbers show it. I mean, we have more prisoners in the U.S. today than all of China. Yeah. And they have 4 times the population.
It's
now
crazy.
Think about that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
There's something really wrong and perverse here, okay? And a lot, not all of those people are in jail for drugs, but a lot of them are in jail for drugs, and a lot of them are in jail for possession, mere possession. This is just wrong.
Yeah.
And this is what I learned doing this book.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm complicit if I don't point this out every single time, that there is a gross injustice happening to people, and it's unnecessary.
And why do you think that is?
There's a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
I think private prisons have contracts with government. The government actually guarantees that the prisons will have a certain number of people in them.
Yeah.
law enforcement gets a stipend from the DEA to enforce laws locally.
Mm.
So basically, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, is administration, pays local cops to do their dirty work, and cops get a schmear for it. And it's in their interest to keep up the drug wars. Mm. They're getting money. They're buying things for their departments and cars and whatever else it is they need. And we need a different system.
Mm.
This just isn't possible anymore. And it's inhuman and it's criminal and it's it gets me really angry.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth. You can apply any word you want to it, but it's just blatantly it's outdated. Let's put it that way. Also, if people are really struggling with problems from drugs and addiction, is a prison a place to put them?
Yeah.
Isn't treatment a better idea?
Yeah.
And cheaper and more modern and more effective?
Mm. I guess it's the difference between criminalizing something and seeing it as a crime versus
an illness.
An illness. And this is, you know, again, we could talk about this for 2 hours. So, you know, I definitely think it's important to talk about. But it'll be hard to conclude it in this one conversation. But specifically, so you mentioned people of color being disproportionately targeted, or whatever you want to call it.
Arrested.
So
jailed.
You're doing the Donald Trump thing.
Criminalized.
Wrong.
It's a nasty system.
Yeah. Have you seen, I think Netflix just put out a documentary called 13, I think, which is about...
I heard it's great.
I haven't watched it yet either. We need to watch that. But I think it's about this exact issue. So I definitely need to check that out. And from your research, you know, you mentioned the private prison system here. How does that compare to the rest of the world? I mean, are there other major... I know nothing about this. So major Western countries, let's say like the UK or... France, Germany, a lot of Europe, do they have similar systems? Or?
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I know they don't have near the number
of
people in. And I can tell you this also, in Portugal, which is very interesting, that's a small country, Portugal, but they decriminalized all drug use in 2002.
Mm.
And they're saving billions of dollars in prison fees. They've lowered the rate of HIV infection. They've, you know, really stopped a lot of needle use. It's not a slam dunk success, but the trend looks very good.
Yeah.
And you can find any number of people who will agree with that.
Mm.
They've been looking at it for about 15 years now almost. So it's not nothing is definitive, but I can tell you this much. Their society has not fallen apart. It has been fraying at the edges, okay?
Yeah.
There's no more corruption, but they're actually treating people with drug issues successfully, more successfully.
Yeah.
That's worth thinking about.
Definitely. Yeah, I guess this isn't specific to cannabis. This is, you know, drugs in general. People in those situations, there's a different mindset you could potentially have. And
it's made me question the entire war on drugs, and it's made me question very deeply if it makes sense at all to make any substance illegal in terms of...
So talking about that, so do you think we could take it a step further? You know, if you were the president of the United States and you had the power to... I don't think the president has the power to do
he
this,
doesn't,
but
he, doesn't, doesn't.
He or she doesn't. But let's just say for hypotheticals, you could make all drugs legal or whatever the term is. Would you be for that?
I personally think that people who want to use these substances do.
That's true. You've never seen a heroin addict say it's
against the law. I shouldn't shoot up.
Yeah.
I mean, right now there's a very large resurgence of psychedelic use, particularly in New York City and around the country. There doesn't seem to be, you know, any prohibition around it.
Yeah.
You want it. You know where to get it. You know what to do. You know, I mean, this is part of our lives, and it has been ever since I was a kid, essentially.
Mm.
So I'm not sure that prohibition works, period. And I'm not even sure why we think it's so important anymore.
Mm.
In a country where alcohol is free, where pharmaceuticals are dispensed like candy, I mean, I do question if there's a vast conspiracy to keep people down or sort of sublimated through it, but that doesn't seem to be the case either. I mean, it doesn't seem like people are that passive. So, you know, I'm torn a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I've always known that Frankenstein, the myth of Frankenstein, was a response to a very scared group of people. They were scared of industrialization, and they were scared of machines taking over the world, right? And I'm not sure that the Brave New World scenario isn't the same, where that we're afraid of drugs because we're afraid it's just going to make us all passive and happy and sort of too happy with our current misery.
Yeah.
So it's really worth thinking about and discussing, but I think we're not at the point yet of having a conversation about this stuff. What do you think?
Specifically on all drugs?
Yeah.
I'd probably need to think about it a little bit more, but I did follow Russell Brand, a guy in the UK who's been a drug addict, and I've watched a lot of his debates and talks on this previously, and I do agree with the fact that if we treat people with some compassion and we can say, okay, you're in a bad state. If you're doing heroin, you're not in a good state. You know, like
stuff is not
going great most of the time in those situations. So, you know, you can argue about the past and what they've done and the ownership and all that stuff. And I agree there's a discussion to be had there. At the same time, as a society, do we want those people to be in a better situation? The answer should be yes.
I think we do.
And if that's the case, then yeah, we should treat it like an illness.
It also seems to me that there's a certain number of people who, whether it's genetic or environment, I don't know, but are more programmed to addiction.
Definitely.
Like, I've never had an addiction problem.
Yeah.
Luckily, thankfully, happily. You know, so my point of view is about me. And by the way, most of my friends and peers, same situation.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. It's more about addiction rather than the substance. Because you don't need to be addicted just to a substance or alcohol. You could be addicted to hard work or to, you know, a number of different things. So I think there is generally a percentage of the population that has that in them, and sometimes, unfortunately, it goes the wrong way. You know, there's 100 variables before that, and, you know, there's societal issues, there's family issues that contribute, there's, you know, all sorts of different things. So it's hard to pinpoint one thing, but if I could pick one, I would veer on the side of compassion and to say, look, someone's in a bad situation. As a society, we want to help them. So, you know, I think there should be punishment for people that are especially going out to harm people. You know, if you're knowingly selling, you know, X drug that you know is just going to make, you know, like heroin, for example, is very different to cannabis, right? If I'm a massive supplier of heroin, I think you should be treated very differently to the user of that.
But it's very interesting to think about. And I don't want to derail the conversation off of cannabis here, but, you know, if things are regulated like heroin, you're going to cut out a lot of misery and death, basically, because at least what you're selling or offering is going to be tested and not lethal. I mean, of course, there will be problems because heroin is so dangerous in that way, but at least you're going to take the bad stuff that gets put into these substances by all sorts of activity that I have no direct experience of. Away, and you're going to reduce the harm. And I think compassion and harm reduction are much more important than this quote unquote law and order stance and imprisonment.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. I'm glad we agree below.
So just finishing things off, it's been super interesting hearing all of that. If people want to go check out your book, what are some of the things that you cover in the book and who might be interested in it?
Well, it's written as a travelogue, and it's sort of my journey from this accidental stumbling upon the plant into understanding the demonization, criminalization of it, to understanding the science and the chemistry of the endocannabinoid system, which I tried to present in a very sort of accessible way. Did I succeed? to looking at the future, people who are trying to design their highs and really use these substances for serious medical conditions and less serious medical conditions. And then sort of the philosophy of how you can use cannabis to do different things like enhance intimacy, enhance connection between people, how to use it not as so much as a party drug, because I've never, it's never really struck me as a party substance. It's, for me, it's always been more about a small group and a way of helping your mind sort of step outside of our linear, rational ways of thinking. And as I write in the book, it occurred to me as I was writing it, it's like, look, we as a society, as a world, really, are undergoing an enormous change. The digital revolution has really changed the game here. And we live in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news cycle where we're constantly at the behest of our phones and we're always on call. And we need a way to get away from that. We need a way to stop. So you can meditate. You can do lots of things to get away. But sometimes you just want to have something to sort of relax.
Yeah.
And help you relax and help you shift your mind a little bit so that you can actually reapproach stuff with new eyes the next day or in a couple of hours. And I think cannabis can be used for that. And I think it's important to start exploring that as a culture.
Yeah. That's great. I think that's a great way to finish things off, man. This has been super interesting. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. You're a happening guy.
And if anyone wants to check out the book, obviously it's on Amazon and any store, right?
Or what's it called?
Brave New Weed.
Exactly.
There we go.
Yeah, it's
a play on
Brave New World.
And how did you actually come up with that? The name of the
book? My publisher came up with it.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
What were some other names that you?
Oh, they were all terrible. I blocked them out of my mind. Yeah. No, they were all dreadful. No. She came up with it over a breakfast meeting one day, and it was like that. I said, "What should I call this thing?" She said, "Brave New Weed." I just thought, again, it's like it's been ubiquitous in our lives, and yet we've known nothing about it. Really, we don't really know about it.
Yeah.
Why? And then when I found out why, I thought, okay, I got to tell the story.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you've definitely told a story and you've got a great background of telling stories. People, please go and check out the book. It is available right now. And it's great to have you on here, man. We've definitely got plenty of other things to talk about in the future. So I'm looking forward to having you back on here.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.